BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. This show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Steve Fanger and Gene Dunford from Blue Beyond are with us in the studio today to play some blues music. Matt's here with more of Matt's very popular If I Were Prime Minister for a Day. This gives you, the public, the chance to change the path of history by introducing your own laws. There's a feature from Dialect's Tony Gosling about the arrest of a student in Nottingham, and Anthea Page brings us news from Bristol Zoo. Malcolm Grieve continues with another chapter of Cider with Rosie. Jeff Sparks gives us the latest in What's On. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. I'd like to welcome Steve Fanger and Gene Dunford. Hello.
Hiya.
You're in Blue Beyond. How long have you been in Blue Beyond?
Oh, God. What is it, about 10 years now?
Yeah, we met through a mutual friend and we've been playing ever since.
Yeah, I had a lot of songs that I'd been writing and I wasn't much of a guitar player. So I'd had a problem kind of, you know, getting those songs across to other musicians in the past. Charlie suggested Gene and I get together. I met Gene and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. It was...
So you hit it off pretty much from the start?
Yeah, yeah. I think there was a kind of a magic right there, wasn't there, in the beginning?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
We have quite a tense creative relationship, let's put it like that.
Okay, I mean, a lot of creative couples are sort of described as being in a sort of platonic marriage of sorts. Do you kind of feel you're in a platonic blues marriage of sorts?
Yeah, it is like that sometimes.
We're always filing for divorce.
What sort of influence in... There's so many blues artists. I mean, what different sides of the blues do you come from? Blues rock or really old blues?
We come from quite different sides of it in a way, don't we?
Completely, yeah.
I mean, so your influences, Gene?
I go for more the hokum, the ragtime, the... what people don't realise is a lot of the blues artists will used to do the equivalent of pop numbers, and I quite like that side of things. So I'm a fan of Mississippi John Hurt rather than Robert Johnson.
Okay.
Well, I came more from that kind of Chicago style. I mean, I started off rock and roll, you know, that was the thing that got me going. Elvis, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, all those guys. But then from Chuck Berry, I drifted into the blues, but it was more the kind of Muddy Waters, Howling Wolf, Chicago sort of blues.
So Steve, how long have you been sort of trying to play the guitar and playing the harmonica and so forth?
Oh, gosh. Well, trying is a good word, yeah. A long time. I guess, you know, 30 years or so.
I mean, I've heard you sing, and you sing very well. Have you always sung?
Yeah, I think it was something I just did right from a kid, you know. I mean, when I was a little baby, you know, my mum used to sing, always used to sing around the house, and she had a voice like an angel. And I guess I just used to perk up and listen to that, you know. It's like, what's that sound? It's so sweet.
I always pick up that people's musical influences often come from sort of very early childhood. I mean, Gene, what was your earliest memory of music and what made you pick up a guitar?
My earliest memory of music. Do you know, when you say that, the thing that comes through my head is 1950s pop music. Things like, how much is that doggy in the window?
Did you like sort of do...
Singing the Blues, actually, was one of my favourites.
Yeah?
And Catch a Falling Star, Perry Como, the other side was Magic Moments. That's my early stuff.
Yeah. What did you sort of do in the 60s then, as a result of listening to all these? You started playing guitar sort of...
I didn't start playing the guitar till it was like that. I picked it up as a diversion from studying my A-levels, so I... Factory doing the exams, so I first picked up the guitar the week I should have been starting my revision.
Okay, well, there you go.
And it's gone downhill ever since.
That'd be an inspiration to people sitting exams everywhere, bored and picking up a guitar. Yes. Yeah, it's not that bad, really. It's not that bad. So how many sort of live gigs have you done over the last 10 years? Lots. I mean, what sort of venues and places do you like to perform?
I mean, we're not, really a prolific band that goes out and plays, you know...
I hate gigging, let's be clear about this.
Gene is not fantastically keen on the idea. You know?
Okay, right.
He comes out on sufferance, you know.
Yeah.
He says, it's all right for you, Stephen, you've just got a harmonica and a microphone to carry. I got four guitars to tune up.
Are you on the more gregarious side, I imagine, then? Are you the one that likes to go out and sing in front of a...
Yeah, crowd? I do love that. You know?
It's always like that in bands. It's the lead singer is the one who's insecure and needs the...
These adulations.
Oh, no.
Now we're opening up the closet.
The audience. Whereas the guitarist is just this, we're all sort of autistic and aspergic and really don't actually have any sense of wanting to connect to other people because we spent years and hours playing.
I mean, you've described yourselves as having the combined age of only slightly less than the Rolling Stones. How do you get along with a lot of music promotion these days? All through the internet. Are you tuned into that at all?
Oh, yeah. So, what's that?
Tuned through the internet, yeah, well...
No, yeah, we've got a MySpace site, or rather...
We're working on it, you know, we're just starting to put it together, and... Okay. Yeah, because it's like, it's opened things up a lot, you know.
All right, well, let's hear a tune now. What have you got for us?
What about your other one? This is an interesting song, because it's a song that Steve has taken from his experience, but he's moulded it, so it's not really his experience.
Okay.
And this is, what about Jack's Takes All? Or is that too...
No, that's okay, yeah. Yeah, this is a song I wrote when I was about 14, actually. That stuff was going on at home. My daddy was a lover. He played a cheating game. My mother died of a broken heart, certified insane. He gambled all his money on a one-way losing streak. When it came to women, charmed them off their feet. He thought he was a king, at his feet we had to fall. But I believe that the Jack is the boss card in the pack. I believe that the Jack takes all. Working to keep us clothed and fed, while Daddy was down at the bookies or in someone else's bed. Before my mother died, she had no peace of mind. Said, Steve, don't blame your daddy for the love he couldn't find. Now Daddy's crown has faded, from grace he had to fall. And I believe that the Jack is the boss card in the pack. I believe that the Jack takes all. My mother was a lover, played a cheating game, died of a broken heart, certified.
Understand one of you, I don't know which, has met a famous blues man. Which one was
that? Mr. Howlin' Wolf.
Mr. Yeah, Howlin' Wolf, yes.
Yeah, that's a little story I'm very fond of telling. It was a long time ago, back in about 1968, when I don't know how old I was then, about 20 or 19 or whatever. And I went to see Howlin' Wolf at the Roundhouse, not the one in Chalkville, but the one in Dagenham. And the support band came out and played, and they went off, and there was a long delay before Howlin' Wolf came out with his stuff. And I'd got right down to the front of the stage. I had a harmonica with me, and I just wailed this thing across the stage. Yeah, long blue note, you know. That's a very low key harp. It was a higher key anyway. And the next thing I know, Howlin' Wolf comes striding out, comes up to the microphone and says, "Come out the boy playing the harp." It's like everybody's pointing at me. It's like, he means you, man. Next thing I know, this big hand comes down and he yanks me up onto the stage. He says, "What harmonica do you have there, son?"
It's a C, Mr. Wolf. He said, turns around to the band, he says, "Oh, blues in G." And the next thing, he just launched into this song, and then next he does a couple of verses, and then he turns around to me and he says, "Now blow your harmonica, son." And I was like, wow, I'm up there on stage with my hero, Howlin' Wolf. I went down to see the guy, the next thing, and there I am, you know, up on the stage with him playing the harmonica.
That's awesome. I'm quite envious. I mean, he's got a hell of a voice. And...
yeah, what an amazing guy, you know, he's just really larger than life, you know.
Mm.
I mean, he was about the same age I am now, and yet just so full of energy and... yeah, amazing. Those old blues guys, they were something else, you know.
Yeah. As a harmonica player, I'm noticing you've got a selection of no less than 6 harmonicas from which you can pick and choose. Describe the intricacies of the instrument.
Well, it's just basically for different keys, you know.
Okay.
The harmonica, you can play each harmonica in several different keys. You know, you can play the harmonica in the key that it's tuned to. When the black guys first started to pick up the harmonica and play it, they didn't play it. Say this is a G harmonica, right?
Yeah.
You would normally just play kind of tunes in G on it.
Yeah.
But when the black guys picked it up, they started to try and make it emulate the human voice, and they sort of got into these blue notes, which were, you know, not really... these harmonicas weren't designed for that
right
at that time, you know. But they got these notes out of it. But when you're playing that, that's a G harmonica, but when you play it like that, you're playing it in D.
Okay.
But you can also change the key around. You can... playing in what they call different positions.
And, okay.
So it's quite a versatile instrument.
All right. Gene, what do you see as the future for blues music? Because a lot of people see it as an old genre. I mean, people like John Mayall were sort of crusading for the blues to keep it alive back in the 60s. What do you see for blues these days?
Well, I think the future of blues music, I mean, I'm not sure it has a future in a pure form. It's become a bit of a sort of... bit like when we were kids, everyone used to play in trad bands, didn't they? You used to go with your parents out and there would be a trad band. And I think that's, in a sense, what's happened to the blues. It's become a bit of a minority hobby pastime.
Mm.
I mean, there are practitioners and they're good. But I think the point is that it actually informs all the major musics, really. It informs jazz, rock, pop. They're all based on the blues. It doesn't have to go anywhere because it's so much part of what we all play, really.
Have you ever been tempted to pick up an electric?
Yeah. I'm crap at electric.
He's not that bad. But he is better. I mean, acoustic is his forte.
Have you been tempted to sort of get any more people involved and put a band together, sort of drums and bass and other musical
projects? Well, we do have a couple of other musicians who play with us on a regular basis, and they go back musically with us for quite a while. Bass player and guy who plays guitar and mandolin. We haven't had a regular drummer. We've used drummers on gigs, but...
Okay, can we see you out live at all at any point?
19th of December.
Yeah.
Friday the 19th of December at the Blue Lagoon on Gloucester Road, down from the Prom.
Another one, yeah.
We're doing a gig there. It always goes down well. It'd be great to have people come along and see that.
Be there or be square.
Well, Steve and Gene, thank you very much for coming and playing music, and I think we're going to hear a bit more from you later on in the show.
Thanks a lot.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
One of the lesser-known victims of the so-called War on Terror is academic freedom here in the UK. It may sound surprising, but university staff in Nottingham reported one of their students to the police recently for downloading a document about Islamic extremism from a US government website. Issam Yazir arrived at his office to find himself arrested under the Terrorism Act just for researching Islamic extremism. Anyway, Issam spoke to Dialect's Tony Gosling last week and explains what happened in his own words.
My name is Issam Yazir and I was arrested on the 14th of May 2008 under the Terrorism Act because a document was found on my University of Nottingham office computer, which was the Al-Qaeda training manual. This document is an open source declassified document that was downloaded from the US government Department of Justice website by a friend of mine, a student friend of mine, who was doing preparing for a PhD in politics, and I was helping him draft the PhD proposal, and he had sent it to me alongside, you know, many various journal articles and books and so on. I was arrested on the spot when I arrived at my office, was questioned for 6 days, and essentially, you know, was had my entire life turned upside down. At the end of the 6 days, when the judge ordered our release, I was essentially told that I'll be deported on immigration charges, very convenient immigration charges that essentially meant they were trying to deport me within the week, even though I've been living in the UK for 14 years. And because I was a foreign national, they could do this. There was a campaign that started in Nottingham to fight this deportation, and luckily succeeded in stopping the deportation. And now I've got a case in court against the Home Office, which I'm hoping to win. And that's the state of play so far.
Can you just describe your arrest? I mean, were you handcuffed and all that sort of thing?
I received a call in the morning from a friend of mine who was asking if I was doing okay, and I said yes. Why? And he said, "There's police officers in your office, and there's security personnel, and the whole place is a mess, looking for you." And I said, "Why?" And you know, he said, "Nobody's telling us why." And I thought it was a break-in, so I turned up to the office, trying to help the police. And what happened was they arrested me on the spot, handcuffed me, put me in a car, took me to the police station, searched me. Then for about 3 hours, we had this very extensive fingerprinting and footprinting procedure. Very painful, by the way. And at the end of it, I had a DNA sample taken from me, was put in a cell for 10 hours, incommunicado, before I had my first interview. And it was then that I discovered that the manual was the reason, the presence of the manual was the reason for the arrest, because up to that point, nobody was telling me anything.
Can you explain what sort of reaction there was from amongst academic staff?
Well, it depends. I mean, the majority of people were very supportive. Some of them were a bit apprehensive about publicly standing up for academic freedom and for freedom to research and for intellectual curiosity, you know, period. But the higher echelons, the authorities of the university, so the very high levels, the very high echelons, were extremely the opposite. I mean, they essentially just were very defensive and really sort of defending their decision to call the police under the guise that there is no right to academic research, there is no right, you know, the people reserve the right to kind of define what was legitimate research, which I find extremely unsettling. And many academics, you know, are up in arms now because of this, and they think it's a shock that we live now in an age where intellectual freedom is now all relative, and you know, it's up to certain, you know, self-appointed authorities to decide what is relevant research material and what isn't. It's all done under the guise of safety first, but you know, if you look at it, this is a very, very spurious sort of pretext. It's very plain to everyone that this is just, you know, the sort of paranoid mindset just, you know, going insane.
Well, what you're saying, though, then, is that it was actually the university authorities that called the police on you, rather than the police doing sort of surveillance of your emails and that sort of thing, that caused the arrest in the first place.
Absolutely. Someone discovered the document on my computer. Within 2 hours, the university senior authorities, i.e. the registrar, or I'm not sure exactly who, but they decided to call the police with against government regulations, by the way. The government regulations say precisely the opposite. You need to do your own internal investigation. They didn't. Within 2 hours, the call was made to the police. The police turned up and decided to arrest me. It's not just the government and the law enforcement agencies which are harboring this sort of paranoid mindset, but it's actually the university authorities themselves, who, instead of upholding the principles of free speech and freedom to inquiry, are you know, just accepting this fear climate and culture of fear. It's quite unsettling and very, very disappointing, of course.
So did they actually come into your room and get access to your computer that way, or is it the sort of university IT security people?
I gave permission to a colleague of mine to go into my computer to look for another document which was work-related, and they came across the Al-Qaeda manual and simply assumed that this was something that to do with obviously preparing for terrorism or something that was dodgy. Mind you, the other thing is that I when I was arrested, the police came into campus and asked various academics to give statements, and one of the police officers who was asked and challenged about their action, whether it was necessary, admitted verbatim saying this would not have happened had these people been blonde and Swedish. It tells us more that the police officer felt quite open about it and quite relaxed about admitting this than the fact that he said it. I think it's quite telling that he's now, you know, the assumption is made that everyone understands the sort of the climate we live in, and that laws must be done in a particular way. That's the sort of thing we have to keep in mind.
Well, we have quite a lot of student listeners to our program. So, have you got any advice to them? Do you think they should avoid anything to do with Al Qaeda or anything to do with the war on terror?
That's the sort of lesson the government is hoping people will learn. I say the very opposite. I think people should be equipped. I think they should be knowledgeable. They should contact a lawyer if they work in research or in a particular sensitive area. Make sure they've got all the protections they can get, because they're not going to get them from the university authorities.
Nottingham University student Issam Yazir there hit the headlines when police and university staff branded him a terrorist for downloading a document from a US government website, talking exclusively to Dialect's Tony Gosling and advising students to carry on asking the difficult questions about the war on terror. Now for some music from a West London six-piece band, the Popes of Chillytown, is called Prove Me Wrong. That was the Popes of Chillytown, Chillytown, playing a track from their album Buy One Get One Free, and you can find out more on Facebook. Matt's popular new feature gives you, the public, your chance to be Prime Minister for a day, and so here is this week's.
Good evening. We've got two members of the public with us today in the studio who would like to be Prime Minister for the day. Hello, Jerry.
Hello.
So, Jerry, tell us what your rules are that you'd like to see passed. What really annoys you?
Well, I've come up with three. One that I think will be popular across the board is to give us an extra bank holiday sometime in the period from August to December.
Perhaps. When it's really grim and horrible and dark.
Yeah, perhaps around the time the clocks go back. We work longer hours than anyone else in Europe, and I think we deserve it.
We're not as bad as America, though.
No, not as bad as America, but we probably don't have their pay packets either.
OK, so just one bank holiday in the year, or are you going to suggest a second one at some point?
Second one would be nice. I think if you were trying to win votes, you might go for a second one. But there will be a knock-on effect on productivity, so I'd settle for one.
So you're being very realistic here, not asking for much. OK, what's the next law?
The next one is something for me personally, and I don't imagine it would be much of a vote winner, but anyone that's licensed to play music in public, I'd like them to play only Bruce Springsteen.
OK, I think that might reach some opposition, but let's move on to your third one.
The third one is something of another personal pet hate. It's around licensing cyclists to get them to take responsibility for their behaviour. they ride on the pavements all the time, and I've been personally knocked down twice whilst walking on the pavement. And then they behave awfully in traffic as well. Not all cyclists, but certainly I've seen terrible behaviour. And I think that why they do it is because they can. There's no way of identifying them, and they don't seem to be answerable to anyone.
Okay, so they need to be able to do some kind of driving test for their to make sure that they're going to ride their bike in a way that's safe.
Yeah, maybe that, but something like a license plate that identifies them.
Okay.
So if someone knocks you down on the pavement and cycles off, you can at least have a go at tracing who did it.
This is a particular problem for me. I walk along the cycle track and it gets very narrow and the bikes go very fast. And as it gets darker and some people are not up to speed with their fluorescent jackets, I've seen some really nasty accidents. And as much as I like to get people out of their cars and see people walking and using the bikes, which is wonderful, it gets very dangerous. Oh. And I would, if a bike hit me and cycled off, as I saw happen the other day to somebody, I'd have no idea who that person was on the bike. So,
Just not accountable at the moment.
Okay, you've had, is that three?
Yeah.
Okay, do we have any others at all? I think we've got two prime ministers in today. We've got Jen. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
Jen, tell us what your laws are. What really bugs you about society?
Well, actually, the first one I've got is something that's been brought up recently, I think by the government, actually, but I don't know quite how they'll put it into practice. But it's with people on benefits, to save them from just spending their benefits on things that not necessarily go down very well.
Maybe that's very diplomatic, Jen.
Yes, I know, and I'm trying to be very diplomatic. Just I'm not quite sure who your listening base is. Maybe give people, instead of just money, give them food vouchers, healthy food vouchers, or even just vouchers that can't be spent on booze and cigarettes. Mm. Not saying that everyone on benefits spends that on that, but I just think it encourages a healthier lifestyle, and also I just think it's better for the next generation to see that happening.
Okay, that sounds very reasonable. Okay, anything else?
Yes, another one is something that's personal to me. It's about giving some sort of benefit to us in the Middle England. I cohabit with my partner. We're not married.
That's a very interesting term, yeah, cohabit.
Cohabit. We don't have children. We both have jobs. We have a mortgage. And we get absolutely nothing for doing that. For doing everything that we're supposed to do, we get nothing for it. And I not necessarily want an awful lot. I just want some sort of recognition that we are doing what we're supposed to be doing, and maybe get maybe a little bit of tax cut here and there, or just like a little bit of benefit somewhere, just to say, yeah, well done, you're doing the right thing, and carry on doing what you're doing.
It reminds me of being a classroom teacher, and it would always be the kids that were neither outstandingly brainy or particularly badly behaved. The ones in the middle who were just average would never get noticed and pass through school with no real kind of acknowledgement, really. So I think in society it's the same, isn't it? You know, if you are really out of order, then you get noticed. If you're brilliant, you get noticed. If you're in the middle, not so much.
And I just don't think it encourages people to do that. Why have jobs and your own home and pay for everything when you can do the opposite and get everything for it?
Okay, so would you, in your kind of, if you're Prime Minister for more than a day, if we're in a parallel universe and you're Prime Minister properly, what kind of country would you kind of aspire to be? Would it be America, where there's very little safety net, or would you go for somewhere like one of the Scandinavian countries that has a huge safety net socially but higher taxes, I guess?
I think somewhere in the middle. The ideal society that I would like, I don't think actually exists. I think my ideal society is a perfect society, and I don't actually think that that exists. So I think sort of a middling. I think I would like to be like the United States.
Okay, so in some ways then the social net we have in this country allows people to get away with a bit too much, but you wouldn't want to go as far as the US.
No, I think the benefit system and that sort of system is here for a reason, and I think as long as people don't take advantage of that, then it's a good thing to have. I just think that sometimes I did this when I was at university, but this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, and It's encouraged through generations, and there's just no way to snap out of that, and it's quite difficult to watch that and just be the middleman.
Okay, Jerry, you're going to quickly end the interview for us with some pearls of wisdom.
Just following on from what Jen said and your comments about America, America operates a taper system where the longer you're claiming benefits, the less you get. So it's not attractive for anyone to be unemployed for 10 years. And in this country, we almost have the opposite, in that the longer you're out of work, either for unemployment or for sickness, the more you get. And it makes it difficult for people to actually find work that pays if they've been on benefit for years.
Okay. So I'm sure we're going to get a lot of listeners who will agree with this, and we'll get a lot that don't agree with it. But it's certainly interesting to start a debate with. And thank you very much for being our prime ministers. And we've had two today. And firstly, we've had
Jen.
And we've also had
Jerry.
So listeners, if you have any thoughts about that, then please get in contact with us on the usual email. We'll give details out later. Thank you very much, prime ministers.
Thank you, Matt, and thank you to Jerry Stone and Jen Lear for their participation this week. And for listeners out there eager to get their opinion across, you can email bristolradiocoop@live.com. And that's Bristol Radio Co-op, all one word.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time once again for another chapter of Sided with Rosie, a bridge especially for dialect and read by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
Sided with Rosie by Laurie Neal. So quiet was Joe always, so timorous yet eager to please, that she was the one I chose first. There were others, of course, louder and more bouncingly helpful, but it was Joe's cool face, tidy brushed back hair, thin body and speechless grace, which provided the secretive prettiness I needed. Unknowingly, therefore, she became the pathfinder, the slender taper I carry to the grottos in whose shadows I now found myself wandering. I used to seek her out on the way home from school, slyly separate her from the others, watch her brass bracelet dangling. Was I 11 or 12? I don't know. She was younger. She smiled easily at me from the gutter. Where are you going then, Joe? Never special? Oh. It was all right, as long as she didn't move. Let's go down the bank then. Shall us? Eh? No answer, but no attempt to escape. Down the bank, like before. How about it then, Joe? Still no answer. No sign or look. She didn't even stop the turning of her bracelet. But she came down the bank all the same, stepping toe-pointed over the ant-heaps, walking straight and near and silent. She showed no knowledge of what she was going for, only that she was going with me. Close under the yews in the heavy green evening, we sat ourselves solemnly down. The old red trees threw arches above us, making tunnels of rusty darkness. Joe, like a slip of yew, was motionless. She neither looked at me nor away. I leant on one elbow and tossed a stone into the trees, heard it skipping from branch to branch. "What shall we do then, Joe?" I asked. She made no reply as usual. "What do you say, Joe?" "I don't mind." "Come on, you tell." "No, you." The pronouncement always had to come from me. She waited to hear me say it. She waited, head still, staring straight before her, tugging gently at a root of weed. "Good morning, Miss Jenkins," I said breezily. "What seems to be the trouble?" Without a blink or a word, Jo lay down on the grass and gazed up at the red-berried yews, stretched herself subtly on her green crushed bed, and scratched her calf, and waited. The game was formal and grave in character, its ritual rigidly patterned. Silent as she lay, my hands moved as silently, and even the birds stopped singing. Her body was pale and milk-green on the grass, like a birch leaf lying in water, slightly curved like a leaf, and veined and glowing, lit faintly from within its flesh. This was not Jo now, but the revealed unknown, a labyrinth of naked stalks, stranger than flesh, smoother than candle-skins, like something thrown down from the moon. Time passed, and the cool limbs never moved, neither towards me nor yet away. She just turned a grass ring round her fingers and stared blindly away from my eyes. The sun fell slanting and struck the spear-tipped grass, laying tiger stripes round her hollows, blinding her body with crimson bars and moving slow colours across her. Night and home seemed far away. We were caught in the rooted trees. Knees wet with dew, I pondered in silence all that Jo's acquiescence taught me. She shivered slightly and stirred her hands. A blackbird screamed in a bush. "Well, that'll be all, Mrs. Jenkins," I said. "I'll be back again tomorrow." I rose from my knees, mounted an invisible horse, and cantered away to supper, while Jo dressed quietly and dawdled home, alone among the separate trees. Of course they discovered us in the end. We must have thought we were invisible. "What about you, young lad? You and Jo, last night?" "Oh, yes, we seen you." A couple of cowmen had stopped me on the road. I denied it, but I wasn't surprised. Sooner or later, one was always caught out. But the thing was as readily forgotten. Very little in the village was either secret or shocking. We merely repeated ourselves. Such early sex games were formal exercises, a hornless charging of calves. But we were certainly lucky to live in a village. The landscape abounded with natural instruction, which we imitated as best we could. If anyone saw us, they laughed their heads off, and there were no magistrates to define us obscene. This advantage was shared by young and old, was something no town can know. We knew ourselves to be as corrupt as any other community our size, as any London street, for instance. But there was no tale-bearing then, or ringing up 999. Transgressors were dealt with by local opinion, by silence, lampoons or nicknames. What we were spared from seeing, because the village protected itself, were the crimes of our flesh written cold on the charge sheet. The shady arrest, the police court autopsy, the headline of magistrates' homilies. As for us boys, it is certain that most of us at some stage or another of our growth would have been rounded up under present law, and quite a few shoved into reform school. Instead, we emerged culpable, it's true, but unclassified in criminal record. No wilder or milder than Battersea boys. We were less ensnared by bylaws. If caught in the act, we got a quick bashing, and the fist of the farmer we'd robbed of apples or eggs seemed more natural and just than any cold-mouthed copper, adding one more statistic for the book. It is not crime that has increased, but its definition. The modern city for youth is a police trap. Our village was clearly no pagan paradise. Neither were we conscious of showing tolerance. It was just the way of it. We certainly committed our share of statutory crime. Manslaughter, arson, robbery, rape, all cropped up regularly throughout the years. Quiet incest flourished where the roads were bad. Some found their comfort in beasts. And there were the usual friendships between men and boys, who walked through the fields like lovers. Drink, animality and rustic boredom were responsible for most. The village neither approved nor disapproved, but neither did it complain to authority. Sometimes our sinners were given hell, taunted and pilloried, but their crimes were absorbed in the local scene, and their punishment confined to the parish. So when, in due time, I breathed the first faint musks of sex, my problem was not one of guilt or concealment, but of simple revelation. That early exploration of Jo's spread body was a solitary studying of maps. The signs upon her showed the way I should go. Then she was folded up and put away. Very soon I caught up with other travellers, all going in the same direction. They received me naturally, the boys and girls of my age, and together we entered the tricky wood. Daylight and an easy lack of shame illuminated our actions. Banks and brakes were our tiring houses, and curiosity our first concern. We were awkward, convulsed, but never surreptitious, being protected by our long knowledge of each other. And we were all of that green age which could do no wrong. So unformed as yet, and coldly innocent, we did little more than mime the realities.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Dialects reporter Anthea Page is at the Bristol Zoo to find out what's on offer over the festive period.
I'm at Bristol Zoo. It's a lovely sunny day. And I'm in the marketing office. And I'm going to talk to...
Lucy Parkinson.
Can you tell us a bit about the zoo and how you attract people, especially over the Christmas period?
Well, we're a 12-acre site in Clifton, just on the edge of Bristol. We're a city zoo, but actually it's a little oasis of greenery in the city, so it's a fantastic place to come all year round, especially on a day like today when it's beautiful blue sky. We have a host of activities on all year round, but in Christmas we've got an awful lot going on this year, so I'll tell you a little bit about that if you want.
That's brilliant, yeah.
We've got the highlight, I think, of the Christmas period is going to be a couple of reindeer that we're getting in on December the 21st.
Real ones?
Real reindeer, yes. We've built a little stable for them, so we're all ready for their arrival and we're all getting very excited. Santa's in his grotto at the moment. Children can come and visit him on the weekends or every day from December the 19th. And then on December the 21st, he's going to be joined by two reindeer called Jingle and Belle.
And will the children be able to feed the reindeer?
Yes, reindeer's favourite food is called lichen, and you are going to be able to buy a small bag of lichen and actually get up close to the reindeer and feed them and maybe stroke their little noses and make a Christmas wish.
And what else have you got laid on over the holiday period?
A popular annual event that we do is our annual Christmas carol concerts. We've been having that for a couple of years now, and it's always proved to be a real highlight. This year, it's on Saturday, December the 20th, and Sunday, December the 21st, from 6 till 8 p.m.
And have you got any other projects over the holidays?
We've got we try and make the zoo as festive as possible at this time of year to really sort of get in the spirit. So we've got animal-shaped Christmas lights dotted around the zoo. We've got a Christmas train that's running around the zoo giving rides to visitors every day. You can even buy your Christmas trees from the zoo car park. They're on sale now, so do pop in and get your Christmas tree here. All goes towards a great cause of conservation at the zoo. As well as that, we've got a couple of animal characters. So we've got the Snowhare and the Penguin. There will be characters walking around the zoo from December the 19th, so you can come and meet them and tell them what you'd like for Christmas. So all in all, we've got a whole host of things going on, as well as the usual 450 different species of animals and different animal enclosures, Seal and Penguin Coast, Twilight World, Reptile House, the Gorilla House. There's always things going on at Bristol Zoo, and it's a fantastic day out.
What about conservation? Do you have any particular conservation project on at the moment?
The Bristol Zoo has conservation at its very core. Everything we do is involved in conservation in one way or another. We have many conservation project partners all over the world.
What other animals are in danger?
A whole host of animals that are endangered, from tiny little insects that you probably wouldn't really know an awful lot about, or butterflies that we exhibit in our butterfly forest, to gorillas, apes, orangutans, you know, the whole spectrum of animals.
Can you tell us a bit about the gorilla webcam?
Yeah, we had a gorilla webcam that we launched in September, and it's proved really popular. It's a camera that is installed on the side of the gorilla house, and it looks out over Gorilla Island, where you can watch our family of gorillas playing outside. But also, we've recently had a second camera that's just gone live, which is inside the house, which means that you can now watch the gorillas playing outside or inside. So it's a really popular piece of equipment, and actually it's great for us.
Do you work with schools at all?
Well, yeah, we work with a lot of schools across Bristol and further afield than that. We've got a fantastic education department who run lessons and all sorts of subjects at the zoo, as well as we take a lot of group bookings from schools and from other groups such as Scouts and Brownies and things like that. And it does make a great sort of group trip to the zoo, or for a class or a school or a college. And there's a lot of educational elements, so it helps with the ticking boxes with the national curriculum and things like that. So it really is a great venue for schools and other groups.
So what's your website if people want to contact you?
So if you want to find out any more information about anything on at Bristol Zoo, visit the website at www.bristolzoo.org.uk.
Thank you.
And for the curious, that was the sound of a South American fur seal, one of the many animals you can see at Bristol Zoo. It's the Christmas season, just over 2 weeks to Christmas Day, which has frightened everybody, including me, as I haven't bought anybody any presents. But here's some festive music. It's called Christmas Song, and was written by Gustav Holst, who was born in Cheltenham in 1874. His most famous work was, of course, The Planet Suite, written between 1914 and 16. Cheltenham resident Gustav Holst there. Jeff Sparks is ready and waiting to deliver the very latest in What's On.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 10th of December, at the Junction in Bristol, UK Subs will be performing with support from Haxel and also the Lone Sharks. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £11 from the Junction. Moving on to Friday, 12th of December, and at the Bunch of Grapes in Bristol, Bazooka Joe will be performing. The gigs will start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 12th of December and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, Kick the Cat will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I pay tribute to Michael Lee. He started his career as a drummer for Little Angels and later went on to perform with acts such as The Cult, The Reformed Thin Lizzy and also Page and Plant. Michael Lee sadly passed away on 25th of November 2008. Here, as a tribute, is the song Gallows Pole, which he performed with Page and Plant.
Gallows Pole. think I see my friends coming right in a mile. So friends, you get some silver, you get a little coke. What did you bring me, my dear friend? Keep me from the gallows pole. What did you bring me? Keep me from the gallows pole. I couldn't get no silver, I couldn't get no gold. You know you're too damn poor to keep me from the gallows pole.
Page and Plant with Gallows Pole. On to Saturday 13th of December, and at the Fiddlers in Bristol, the Soul Destroyers will be performing with support from Little Stampede. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door. Also on 13th of December, and at the Croft in Bristol, Babel will be performing with support from The Cedar. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 14th of December, at the Carlin Academy in Bristol, The Damned will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Yeah, I'd particularly like to hark back to Hacksaw playing at the Junction on Wednesday the 10th, because, of course, we had them in for an interview a couple of weeks ago, and they were excellent interviewees, and they get the Dialect official seal of approval. And to finish the show, Steve and Gene once again from Blue Beyond. What have you got for us to finish the show?
This is called Midlife Crisis Blues. Your eyesight starts to dwindle, then your hearing goes. Hair on your head receding, sprouting from your ears and nose. It's a no-win situation. Oh, but it's so hard to lose. All those things you took for granted before the midlife crisis blues. Look in the mirror, it's enough to make you weep. You lost the fight with gravity while you were asleep. It's a touchy situation, and it just sneaks right up on you. They really put you through some changes, those old midlife crisis blues. Down at the local job center, I knew I was pushing my luck. You see, I still haven't quite decided what to do when I grow up. It's a depressing situation. Oh, what can a poor man do? Just when I thought life was gonna be simple, here come those midlife crisis blues. A younger man. She said, Steve, if you can't cut the mustard, I know a man that can. That's a hellish situation. Oh, tell me, can a poor man do? Just to keep from going under with those midlife crisis blues.
And just a reminder to the audience out there, on the 19th of December, they're going to be at the Blue Lagoon, which is on Gloucester Road.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's the end of this week's Radio Dialect Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Today's studio guests were Steve Fanger and Jean Dunford from Blue Beyond. You can check them out at the Blue Lagoon, and that's on Gloucester Road, near the Bottoms Up, on the 19th of December. The feature on Ijam Yazir was brought to us by Tony Gosling. Prime Minister for a Day was the inspiration of Matt Heap, and today's Prime Ministers were Jerry Stone and Jen Lear. Email bristolradiocoop@live.com if you're interested in participating. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of Side of His Rosie, to be continued next week. The Zoo feature was by Anthea Page, and Jeff Sparks brought us What's On, and Villis Chichkuran was the studio engineer, assisted by Mark Condon. This week's show is produced by Anthea Page, and you can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Goodbye from all of us here at Dialect. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Until next week, take care of yourselves, and goodbye.